Welcome to the Africa Speaking Podcast. The podcast discusses critical issues about the African continent. It is brought to you by Teresa Communications in Nairobi. My name is Kimani Njogu. So thank you very much, Kamoji Washira, for really speaking with me today on issues of climate change adaptation in Africa. Let's start from the work you have done around environment and climate change, and the experiences that you have actually seen, encountered along the way.
Thank you for inviting me. I have been quite active in environmental matters. I trained in ecology, botany, forestry, natural resource conservation, and came back to Kenya in 1968-69, worked with the fisheries department, the Ministry of Natural Resources then, and then went away with the UN FAO to Canada, Israel, and Zambia to work with fishery inventorying. And I noticed then how far behind our continent was in simple environmental and natural resources matters. We were still colonial and had not had the institutions to confront the both natural resource environment and such issues. When I came back to Kenya, we tried at the fisheries department to engineer the thinking to a more modern way of natural resource management, but the government was very resistant. The personnel was feeling challenged because of turf issues, so it didn't go very far. I soon left because of the Ndegwa Commission and went back to Canada for my PhD studies at McGill, where I specialized in land and regional management. When I came back to do research in Kenya on land issues, it was clear that the one good thing about colonial practice, although it was enforced and very cruel, was conservation of soils. That even that minor inheritance had been allowed to go, that soil erosion in Kenya is one of the worst anywhere. Again, we tried and failed to bring up new ways of doing it and making people aware. I then applied and got employed by the university at Kenyatta University College then as a teacher in biogeography and ecology, and taught my students, if I may jump ahead, the importance of environmental management and the improvement by Kenyan people, how to husband the resources so that they last over generations, because the rate we are going at it, we're going to lose quite rapidly. We started by forestry. I remember taking my students to Kimakia Forest, which was being cleared to plant exotic timber trees like pines. We tried to protest that and say, this is not the right way. You're losing water resources by doing this. You're spoiling the forest and its climatic effects. And what you are planting is not the same as the mature climactic forest that was. And in doing that, if I may cut a long story short, I had students do some games, learning games. And I remember in one of them, we talked about community conflicts in declining resources. It had to do with Nandi, Triki, if you remember that conflict between the Triki and the Nandi about the forest. And the students did such a good job that for some reason, the spies within the campus took it straight to State House, and Moi the next weekend announced that some lecturers are teaching evil things about forest conservation and denounced my course in a public rally. But to come back to your question, we used to teach climate change. It was called global warming then. And at that time, unfortunately, we taught the physics of it, the wavelength and how carbon dioxide helps the atmosphere capture more heat and keep it, methane and so on, and how industrialization and burning of forest and grasslands exacerbates that. So just the other week, I was going through town and I met one of those students. He's now a bit older, and he said, "Mualim, I'm so glad you taught us this. What you said was right. Look at us now. We are in a climate crisis." By the way, we don't call it climate change anymore. We call it the climate emergency.
The climate emergency.
That's right.
Why do we call it the climate emergency?
Because we have reached a point where, in many cases, some of the impacts and effects are coming close to being an emergency. Not quite completely irreversible, but close. That's why. It's like a house burning. There comes a point where you can save it, or if you're not fast enough, it's gone for good.
Which takes me now to this question about climate emergency and its effects on the African people. We can start feeling that things are changing rather sharply.
Right.
Can you sketch some of these effects?
Some of the impacts.
Yeah, the impact.
I think now everybody has seen one or other impact of a changing climate. I think the most severe for Africa is drought. And drought is one side of flooding. It's like a coin. In Africa, I think one big influence to drought is the global circulation of El Niño, La Niña. So that during La Niña, you tend to have drought. And in many cases, during El Niño, we get floods, destructive floods. What climate change brings about is accelerating of whatever effect there is. If it's drought, it becomes more severe. If it's floods, that's too much rain, becomes way, way too much. And those two are critical for us because of farming and as well as habitats, especially for pastoralists. But another new impact that is of considerable importance is heat. You'll find that heat is going to be raised very rapidly and very high. Sometimes to unknown levels. The human body can take about from 16 degrees centigrade up to about 30, 31 comfortably. But the minute we start going to 35, 40, 45, 50 degrees in the shade, leave alone in the sun, that means human body cannot survive there. It's uninhabitable. And you're approaching that in the Sahel, the Red Sea coast of Africa, the Horn of Africa, which includes Kenya, and quite a few regions in Southern Africa, the Namib, Kalahari, Western Cape, as well as many hot days, way, way too hot for the kind of construction of homes that we have. This is going to be the biggest, single biggest immediate impact, heat, that the bodies, human bodies and livestock cannot tolerate those levels of temperature. Another thing about temperature is that when it gets hot, we are used to a decline at night, a lowering of temperature. So the body is cool, the body recovers. But something that's happening with this emergency is that at night, the temperature remains pretty much, it's sometimes higher because of walls and roofs than it was during the day. If there's a dip, it's only 1 or 2 degrees. That's not enough. So that by 1 o'clock at night, the temperature may change by 2 degrees, but it has been high the whole day. So bodies will not recover. So the effect of that is old people, sickly people, people with other issues, morbidities, will not survive as well. There'll be high death rates or high sickness rates. So that normally meant in nature that if there are no boundaries, national boundaries and borders and nation states, people migrate. So they migrate internally from the lowlands, the hot, uninhabitable areas, to where it's cooler, both them and their livestock. I think it's already started.
It's already started, but and people used to migrate before the colonial experience. But now we have borders. We have the sheer inability for big populations to move from one state to another state on account of heat. So the free movement of people across Africa as a solution is not there anymore.
Good. I'll come to that. I want to add a small list of other impacts, which are just as critical. One of them is sea level rise. I saw a little documentary on NTV about Kipini losing so much land.
Kipini on the Kenyan coast.
Ungwana Bay, yes. Where the mouth of the Tana is. So much land, so quickly. So loss of coastal erosion, it's called coastal erosion, loss of beach land, coastal land, and the swamping, you might say, the seawater undermining the freshwater. So that if you have a well inland, it has become salty, brackish. It used to be 10, 20 years ago, it used to be fresh water. So all those people will be impacted very badly. And these are economic activities taking place there. So that will be wiped out. So sea level rise, as well as the heating of the seas, the oceans, meaning that a lot of the fish, coral reefs will die, breeding grounds will disappear for fish. Those are effects of considerable importance around Africa. Nigeria, Mozambique, for example, will lose a lot of coastal lands. Mangroves are no longer as important as they used to be because this is too big even for them to help. They are good, but the situation is such that erosion will go on anyway. The other impact, of course, is disease. Some vectors like mosquitoes and such are going to thrive in this new climate. So there's a public health issue right there and many others.
Including, the pandemics. I mean, there are these, almost like global diseases that we are experiencing that may be attributable.
That's right.
To climate change, effect.
The migration of animals closer to where people live or people closer to where animals live, the exchange of viruses. And diseases, yes. We have examples of those.
Food insecurity.
Food insecurity, as I was mentioning, drought and so on. Or floods also affect food security. You notice the lakes rising. I think the lakes rising in the rift may be related, but some people think it's a geologic thing happening. It's not quite clear yet. But Lake Victoria comes up and down according to the rainfall regime. So that too will lose a lot of land if there's too much rain. There are some invisible impacts, and that is the stress, the mental stress, psychological stress caused by migrations, uncertainty about what's coming, the fear of the weather, kind of biblical fear of the weather itself, whereas you took it as granted, unpredictability, all those things. And so there's a public health issue right there.
Declining resources. And of course, poverty, violence. Are we likely to experience conflict. More conflict and so on?
Competition for resources. I think you are a bit extreme in saying masses of people moving. It would be wrong to think of people moving en masse. It happens. But generally, people are conservative. They want to stay where they live. extreme circumstances mean that or push them to think of going elsewhere. And usually it's the young ones. So those leave. The ones left are the old, sickly ones. So rarely is it going to be a sort of predictable movement. It's one by one, accelerated rate. Before you know it, there's density in some places and no people in others. That's how it'll happen. However, those are the current situations. If you look ahead, adaptation is about adapting to the current and also foreseeing what is likely to happen in the future. So you try to adapt both. That's where policy comes in. What policies are helping people adapt to the present at the national or regional level? And what policies are looking ahead over the horizon and creating scenarios of what might happen in order to engineer, for example, buildings today to withstand 20 years from now? Two sides of the problem.
So what are those things that we can do, both at the national level in terms of governments, but also at the community level, to be able to adapt to this drought, the heat, the challenges that come with the climate, you know, change situation in which we find ourselves?
There is an element of knowledge for the communities which can be generalized from experts. But there is a level of knowledge which can only come from good, well-organized public institutions, what we used to call extension services in farming. Most of the neo-colonies that we have now, like Kenya, that has disappeared. It has been degraded to where it's non-existent unless it's some foreign aid or NGO trying as a matter of routine government function, which it used to be during the colonial times. After independence, it has been destroyed. That needs to be revived in terms of climate awareness, climate preparation, climate avoidance of damage and impact. And such things are, they have to be institutionalized. The community can only do so much. Planting trees is good, but it's not going to stop the house blowing away in the wind. So some community practices, while useful and to be encouraged, cannot work alone. This thing is too big for small actions. It needs big, national, well-funded, and well-targeted initiatives which are relevant to each community because they are not one size fits all. Give you an example. One thing that you'll notice with the climate emergency is going to be the increasing speed of wind. A little breeze will become a strong breeze. A big windstorm will become hurricane level. And you might even begin to get little tornadoes that blow about. And that means that a lot of the construction we have in Kenya cannot withstand the wind, the rain, and the stormy weather ahead. And the reason that is going to be important is because if there is so much heat in the oceans, so much heat in the atmosphere, that humidity is the energy that gives power to destruction, helps destroy homes, farms. For example, banana trees will fall easily. And then there's no way you can prop them up unless you put concrete. And infrastructure, floods take away roads, landslides. Those impacts cannot be a community affair. Those are national, well thought out. I fear that from what I've seen of our governments, it is not possible. I should list at the adaptation level, at the community level, there are, I mentioned a few, but some things that need to be done. I can list them one by one. I think one is to secure the shacks that people live in the not so privileged areas. Those are so vulnerable that there must be ways architects and engineers can quickly help, that people can survive. There must be something we can do to ensure that they don't go away in one windstorm and getting worse. That means the way they build them, or if they're already built, if they can be retooled to withstand at least moderate. That's one. But in building houses, the Kenyan national codes and regulations given to engineers and architects has to change to include simple, affordable things that for future houses, because of future impacts, will be able to withstand a certain degree of wind speed and rain and so on. And for the ones already built, which the roof can go with the wind, they can be retooled to withstand current and coming, say bracing the roof, bracing the pillars. Those things are there. They are known. The UN has published them for poor countries. We just need to implement. The third one is soil cover, vegetation. The colonial government had a whole bunch of good practices that protect the soil. They were badly implemented. We can do them in a humanistic way to protect the soil, cover the soil, stop it eroding away. Communities can do that. And I think what Wangari was doing is partly like that. Finally, we are talking about new policies in some cases, as well as new regulations for old laws in order to make sure that current and future impacts are taken care of. Building a house, they should have water collection, a tank to preserve so that availability of water goes 2, 3, 4 weeks or a month beyond the end of the rains. Okay, any kind of storage should be encouraged. Building houses not in the riverine areas. Don't invite flooding, taking your home. All those things should be implemented. Grabbing river land and stealing it and doing the wrong things with it. All these things are possible now and can be done community, local levels. And they do a bit of mitigation of the damage likely to happen.
That's very good, because there is work to be done at the policy level, you know, through leadership. There is work to be done within the educational system.
Right.
There is work to be done through the extension, the link,
yeah.
The extension workers and the communities, and very, very specific things that you have, and the professionals.
And the training them as well, and the media.
What type of leadership is required? Because it's clear that you do require something. To help communities. Is there a type of political leadership that would be required to buttress, to protect communities and to be able to work with communities?
If we had MPs which represent their people, their constituency, for some reason in Africa, a member of parliament, as soon as elected, goes and turns around and becomes an individual, ready to, I think, sell out to whoever will purchase. And in many cases, other than a few hangers-on or elites, access to that MP in order to access services or even access policy is very limited. And most people have long since given up trying. So the community is abandoned until the next election. So in an emergency like this, the few institutional assistance possible in a governance way are not accessible. And that is the local representative, at the county level, the county government, the MP and the national government policy. I don't know what senators are supposed to do in this, but there you are. In order to reach the executive, which in many cases, despite promises since the last 40 years, despite promises and manifestos, seem to do much what they like in terms of the needs, the immediate, even urgent emergency needs. If climate change or climate emergency is treated as an urgent problem of the moment, we would be having discussion on what can we do at the national level, regional level, African Union level before we even go to the UN level so that we can help communities start to confront. So what we have now is communities doing the utmost in some cases, either in desperation, a bit of ignorance, and hope that the little they can do will help. I can assure you, in many cases, it's unlikely to, because what do they do when the bridge, the only bridge to their place is gone because of floods, or the whole hillside goes down the hill, or there's drought of immense proportions, like the last one. If it didn't rain this last rains a bit, that drought was a killer drought.
So does that mean then that a new political mindset is required rather urgently? Because, you know, we said we have a climate emergency. We have communities trying their best to deal with this situation, but they are disconnected in a sense from the leaders because the leaders are looking at their own self-interests and so on. How do we solve the problem? I mean, how do we get it to a point where we are treating this as an emergency at all levels?
There is no simple answer to that, but the political system as we have it is not the solution. It may even be the problem. First of all, you know about the corruption. That any bit of funds disappears before it hits the ground. But it's up to the people to take their sovereign interest and, one, vote according to that, then hold the winner who they voted for, hold him to account, you know, put fire under their feet, make sure they deliver, and if they don't, why, what happened? Make sure they don't go and sell out and abandon you. That is the first problem for not just Kenyan, but most African countries. They don't have representation at the national level. How do they get it? That discussion needs to take place, and then action follow quickly. That, given the current practice of politics. But there's also the reforming and revolutionizing the system we inherited. Think more deeply and see how can you make communities more sovereign and more independent of the sharks that steal power from them and money from them and leave them in suffering. That question is more important than the first one. And I would say we do that first, organize so that we can be more in control of our fate and in control of our government and in control of our national budget, and make sure accountability backwards to us is ensured. At the moment, there isn't. So, kwa Kiswahili, tunasema ni mtoto wa kambo mwa Afrika.
Kamoji, I know that you worked very closely with Wangari Maathai in the Green Belt movement, and she did quite a bit of work around planting of trees and other environmental issues. Could you sketch a little bit about the significance of that work?
Wangari Maathai is important in the kind of question you asked about communities, because she was able to galvanize, to mobilize ordinary people, not the elites, not NGOs, but ordinary women to be aware of the importance of environment, particularly forest and plant cover to the soil for both ecological, environmental benefits as well as economic, where you can harvest some things. And we must remember what she constantly said, which is that you cannot separate that practice of environmental protection, planting trees and so on, from the politics of the situation. Most women in those communities didn't want to venture thus into politics. But Wangari convinced them, we can do that very well, but it's of no purpose in the long run if we don't address the very politics that comes and does the opposite. And for that, she got into great trouble. And I'm proud to say that Wangari was an excellent a scientist in zoology, I believe, veterinarian. She specialized in ticks, animal ticks. And once I found her in the office, in the lab there, looking at the microscope, at the brains of a tick or something. Admirable. And I feel a bit guilty because I may have influenced to pull her out of that. So veterinarian science lost in order to see the importance of the larger environment. And I don't regret the fact that she took it up. And she proved that there is no environmental protection without democracy, without people having a larger say, and eventually, of course, controlling the government that so influences these things, which is what I started by saying. For that, she got the Nobel, and that was a recognition of that fact of democracy, environment, community. I think if you haven't seen the film, we made a film called Taking Root, and it should be seen by as many people who can. So recommend it in your podcast.
Absolutely. Taking Roots. And I remember also in her book, she talks about the missing link to Africa's development as culture, you know, that she really felt strongly that to the extent that we do not pay attention to African cultures, the cultures of our people, then we cannot have inclusive development. And that chapter is a very, very powerful chapter in her book. I also know that she felt strongly, really, really strongly about the ordinary citizen. Mm. So she was always talking about the ordinary citizen, the rural people, you know, especially considering that Africa has over 80% of our people actually living in the rural areas. So she paid attention to that.
Yeah.
We do not think, or we do not pay sufficient attention to the work that she did and how that could be pushed forward to deal with the contemporary problems that we currently face. So again, I want to thank you because I'm aware that you did a lot of work behind the scenes, you know, with her as an individual.
Right.
I also know that you did a lot of work behind the scenes within the Green Belt movement.
Yes, I was the international vice president, which was not behind the scenes. We tried to get a little funding for them from overseas, and it helped those days. But no longer.
Of course, there was the international obligation and connection, but I'm also aware that about the ideation,
the political side. Yes, also pulling her out, and yes, and now that you mentioned, we went to Oslo together. There's a problem of an African who stands out and does well. The big risk you have to watch is that the foreign imperialist institutions want to grab that brain and use it and weaken it a little bit. When you went to Oslo, there was a bit of that beginning to happen. For example, the Kenyan side was cut off and Wangari was taken as an individual. The women, I had made sure that the common women were involved in going to Oslo. And that is a lesson by our people. If you excel, keep it within our people to the extent possible and beware that there are forces which may want otherwise. Don't allow yourself to be bought.
And I think you're so right in saying we should be careful to avoid the alienation that comes with our access to certain institutions as individuals, and to remain loyal to the collective that enabled us to excel in the first place.
That's right. That's how I practice myself. You notice I am not in the limelight. I do things that, as much as possible, go to the community, to the collective, and shield it a bit, as much as I can, from the ones who want to subvert them. That's my practice. Hence, people don't know me.
Absolutely. Kamoji Washira, it's always a pleasure hanging out with you because many people do not know you. And you are visible in certain domains and you remain invisible in other domains,
yeah,
out of practice.
Yeah, it's matokeo.
Thank you very much, Kamoji Washira, for having this conversation with me. We hope that some of these ideas that you have shared with me can be used by our communities so that they can make life better for themselves now as well as for the future generations.
Well, I enjoyed this very much. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for listening to the Africa Speaking Podcast. Join us in our next episode brought to you by Twaweza Communications in partnership with Forum Sieve. For any comments and views, you can reach us through our website, www.africaspeaking.org. You can also reach us on Facebook, Twaweza Communications, or on our X handle, @twawezacoms. You can also write to us on email, info@africaspeaking.org.